and those with the potential to become Sith Lords, and only those with such potential, are trained here on Korriban. Bane felt a shiver of excitement. Through strength I gain power. Korriban was the ancestral home of the Sith,
Cordis explained.
This planet is a place of great power. The dark side lives and breathes in the very core of this world.
He paused and slowly extended his skeletal hand palm upward. It almost seemed as if he was cradling something unseen, something precious and invaluable in his claw-like fingers.
This temple we stand in was built many thousands of years ago to collect and focus that power. Here, you can feel the dark side at its strongest.
He closed his fist so tightly that his long fingernails cut into his palm, drawing blood.
You have been chosen because you have great potential,
he whispered.
Great things are expected of the apprentices here on Korriban. The training is difficult, but the rewards are great for those who succeed.
Through power, I gain victory.
Cordis reached out and placed his wounded palm on the crown of Bane's bare scalp, anointing him with the blood of a Sith Lord. Bane had seen plenty of blood as a soldier, yet for some reason, this ceremonial act of self-mutilation revolted him more than any battlefield gore. It was all he could do not to pull away.
You have the potential to become one of us, one of the Brotherhood of Darkness. Together, we can cast off the shackles of the Republic.
Through victory, my chains are broken, Bane thought.
But even those with potential can fail,
Cordis finished.
I trust you will not disappoint us.
Bane had no intention of doing that. The next few weeks passed quickly as Bane threw himself into his studies. To his surprise, he discovered that his inexperience with the Force was the exception, rather than the rule. Many of the students had trained for months or years before they'd been accepted at the Academy on Korriban. At first, Bane found this troubling. He'd just started his training, and he was already behind. In such a competitive, ruthless environment, he would be an easy target for every other student. But as he mulled it over, he began to realize he might not be as vulnerable as he'd thought. He alone, of all the apprentices at the Academy, had been able to manifest the power of the dark side without any training at all. He'd used it so often, he'd come to take it for granted. It had given him advantages over his opponents in cards and brawling. In war, it had warned him of danger and brought him victory in otherwise impossible circumstances. And he'd done it all on instinct, with no training, without even any conscious idea of what he was doing. Now, for the first time, he was being taught to truly use his abilities. He didn't have to worry about any of the other students. If anything, they should be worrying about him. When he completed his training, none of the others would be his equal. Most of his learning came at the feet of Cordis and the other masters. Kasim, Orilpha, Shenayag, Hazorin, and Borthus. There were group training sessions at the Academy, but they were few and far between. The weak and the slow could not be allowed to hold back the strong and ambitious. Students learned at their own pace, driven by their desire and hunger for power. There were, however, nearly 6 students for every master, and the apprentices had to prove their worth before one of the instructors would spend valuable time teaching them the secrets of the Sith. Though he was a neophyte, Bane found it easy to garner the attention of the Sith Lords, particularly Cordis. He knew the extra attention would inevitably breed animosity in the other students, but he forced himself not to think about that. In time, the additional instruction he got from the masters would allow him to catch up to and pass the other apprentices. And once he did, he wouldn't need to worry about their petty jealousies. Until then, he was careful to stay out of the way and not draw attention to himself. When he wasn't learning from the masters, he was in the library studying the ancient records. As the Jedi kept their archives at their temple on Coruscant, so the Sith had begun to collect and store information in the archives of Korriban's temple. However, unlike the Jedi library, where most of the data was stored in electronic, hologramic, and holocron formats, the Sith collection was limited to scrolls, tomes, and manuals. In the 3,000 standard years since Darth Revan had nearly destroyed the Republic, the Jedi had waged a tireless war to eradicate the teaching tools of the dark side. All known Sith holocrons had been either destroyed or spirited away to the Jedi Temple on Coruscant for safekeeping. There were many rumors of undiscovered Sith holocrons, either hidden away on remote worlds or covetously hoarded by one of the Dark Masters eager to keep its secret knowledge for himself. But all efforts by the Brotherhood to find these lost treasures had proved futile, forcing them to rely on the primitive technologies of parchment and flimsoplast. And because the collection was constantly being added to, the indexes and references were hopelessly out of date. Searching the archives was often an exercise in futility or frustration, and most of the students felt their time was better spent trying to learn from or impress the masters. Perhaps it was because he was older than most of the others, or maybe because his years of mining had taught him patience. Whatever the explanation, Bane spent several hours each day studying the ancient records. He found them fascinating. Many of the scrolls were historical records, recounting ancient battles or glorifying the deeds of ancient Sith lords. By itself, the information had little practical use, but he could see each individual work for what it actually represented. A tiny piece of a much larger puzzle. A clue to a much greater understanding. The archive supplemented what he learned from the masters. It gave context to abstract lessons. Bane felt that in time, the ancient knowledge would be the key to unlocking his full potential. And so his understanding of the Force slowly took shape. Mystical and unexplainable, the Force was also natural and essential, a fundamental energy binding the universe and connecting all living things within it. This energy, this power, could be harnessed. It could be manipulated and controlled. And through the teachings of the dark side, Bane was learning to seize hold of it. He practiced his meditations and exercises daily, often under the watchful eye of Cordis. After only a few weeks, he learned to move small objects simply by thinking about it. Something he would have thought impossible only a short time before. Yet now he understood that this was only the beginning. He was starting to grasp a great truth on a deep fundamental level. That the strength to survive must come from within. Others will always fail you. Friends. Family. Fellow soldiers. In the end, each person must stand alone. When in need, look to the self. The dark side nurtured the power of the individual. The teachings of the Sith Masters would make him strong. In pleasing them, he could unlock his full potential and one day sit among them. When the first wave of the attack came, the Republic fleet orbiting the skies of Rusan was caught completely unprepared. A small and politically insignificant planet, the heavily forested world had been used as a base to stage devastating hit-and-run attacks against the Sith forces stationed in the nearby Kashyyyk system. Now the enemy had turned that same strategy against them. The Sith struck without warning, materializing en masse from hyperspace. An almost suicidal maneuver for such a massive fleet. Before an alarm could even be sounded, the Republic ships found themselves being bombarded by three dreadnought cruisers, two Corsair battleships, dozens of interceptors, and a score of buzzard fighters. And at the head of the attack was the flagship of the Brotherhood of Darkness, the Sith destroyer, Nightfall. In his meditation sphere aboard Nightfall, Lord Khan was directing the assault. From inside the chamber, he could communicate with any of the other ships, issuing his orders with the knowledge they would be instantly and completely obeyed. The chamber was alive with light and sound. Glowing monitors and flashing screens beeped incessantly to alert him to the constantly changing updates on the status of the battle. The Dark Lord, however, never even glanced at the screens. His perception extended far beyond the meditation sphere, far beyond the data spit out by the electronic readouts. He knew the location of each vessel engaged in the conflict, his own and those of the enemy. He could sense every volley fired, every evasive turn and roll, every move and counter-move made by every ship. Often he could sense them even before they happened. His brow was knotted in intense concentration. His breath came in long, ragged gasps. Beads of perspiration rolled down his trembling body. The strain was enormous, yet with the aid of the meditation sphere, he maintained his mental focus, drawing on the dark side of the Force to influence the outcome of the conflict despite his physical exhaustion. The art of battle meditation, a weapon passed down from the ancient Sith sorcerers, threw the enemy ranks into chaos, feeding their fear and hopelessness, crushing their hearts and spirits with bleak despair. Every false move by the opponent was magnified. Every hesitation was transformed into a cascade of errors and mistakes that overwhelmed even the most disciplined troops. The battle had only just begun, and it was already all but over. The Republic fleet was in complete disarray. Two of its four Hammerhead-class capital ships had lost primary shields in the first strafing run of the Buzzards. Now the Sith dreadnoughts were moving in, targeting the suddenly vulnerable hammerheads with their devastating forward-mounted laser cannons. On the verge of being crippled and left utterly helpless, they were just now managing to scramble their own fighters to ward off the rapidly closing enemy cruisers. The other two capital ships were being ravaged by rage and fury, the Sith battleships. The ponderous Republic hammerheads relied on support ships to establish a defensive line to hold off enemy attackers, while they positioned themselves to bring their heavy guns to bear. Without these defensive lines, they were all but helpless against the much quicker and more nimble Corsairs. Rage and fury cut in along a vector that minimized the number of cannons the hammerheads could target them with, then swept across their bows, firing all guns. When the Hammerheads tried to change direction to bring more guns to bear, the Corsairs would pivot and double back for another pass along a different vector, inflicting even more damage. The savage maneuver was known as slashing the deck, and without the support of fighters or battleships of their own, the capital ships couldn't withstand it for long. Aid from the Republic battleships, however, was not likely to come. The one on point patrol was already a charred and lifeless hull, obliterated in the first seconds of the attack by a direct hit from Nightfall's guns before it could raise its shields. The other two were being swarmed by interceptors and pounded by Nightfall's broadside laser artillery and didn't figure to last much longer than the first. Khan could feel it. Panic had set in among the Republic troops and commanders. His attack was pure offense. His strategy maximized damage, but left his own ships exposed and vulnerable to a well-organized counterattack. But no such response was forthcoming. The Republic captains were unable to coordinate their efforts, unable to establish their lines of defense. They couldn't even organize a proper retreat. Escape was impossible. Victory was his. And then suddenly fury was gone, snuffed out by an explosion that ripped the Corsair apart. It had happened so quickly that Khan, even with the precognitive awareness of his battle meditation, hadn't sensed it coming. The two hammerheads had turned at tangential angles, both somehow locking in on Fury's path simultaneously. One had opened up with its forward cannons to take down Fury's shields, while the other had unleashed a barrage of laser fire at the exact same spot, causing a massive detonation that destroyed the battleship in the blink of an eye. It was a brilliant maneuver. Two different ships, perfectly coordinating their efforts while under relentless assault to wipe out a common foe. It was also impossible. Khan ordered rage into evasive action. The Corsair peeled off its attack run just as the Hammerheads opened fire. narrowly avoiding the fate of its sister ship. The dreadnoughts closing in on the crippled hammerheads were also forced to break off their attack run as four full squads of Republic fighters burst forth from the cargo bays of their supposedly defenseless prey. Even under ideal conditions, it would have been hard to scramble the fighters so quickly. In this situation, it was unthinkable. Yet Khan could feel them. Nearly 50 Auric fighters flying in tight formation, pressing the attack on the dreadnoughts, while all four hammerheads pulled back. They were establishing a defensive line. Drawing on the power of the dark side, Lord Khan pushed out with his will to touch the minds of the enemy. They were grim but not desperate. Some were afraid, but none panicked. All he felt was discipline, purpose, and resolve. And then he felt something else. Another presence in the battle. It was subtle, but he was certain it hadn't been there at all in the first few minutes of the attack. Someone was using the Force to bolster the morale of the Republic troops. Someone was using the light side to counter the effects of Khan's battle meditation and turn the tide. Only a Jedi Master would have the strength to oppose the will of a Sith Lord. Korpesh felt it too. Strapped into the seat of his interceptor, he was spinning and swerving through the Hammerhead's barrage of anti-fighter turret blasts when the presence of the Jedi Master crashed over him like a wave. It caught him off guard, causing him to lose his focus for a split second. For any other pilot, that would have been enough to end his life. But Korpesh was no ordinary pilot. Reacting with a quickness born of instinct, honed by training, and bolstered by the power of the dark side, he slammed the throttle back and pushed hard on the stick. The interceptor lurched down and forward into a sharp dive, narrowly ducking beneath three successive blasts of the Hammerhead's ion cannons. Pulling out of the dive, he banked into a wide roll and circled back toward the largest of the four Republic cruisers. The Jedi was there. He could sense him. The Force was emanating from the ship like a beacon. Now, Korpesh was going to kill him. Back on Nightfall, Khan was also locked in mortal combat with the Jedi Master, though theirs was a battle waged through the ships and pilots of their respective fleets. The Republic had more ships with greater firepower. Khan had been relying on the element of surprise and his battle meditation to give the Sith the advantage. Now, however, both of those advantages had been nullified. Despite his strength, the Dark Lord was no expert in the rare art of battle meditation. It was one of many talents, and he'd worked to develop them all equally. The opposing Jedi, however, had likely been trained from birth for just such a confrontation. The tide of the battle was slowly turning, and the Dark Lord was becoming desperate. He gathered his will and lashed out with a sudden surge of dark side power, a desperate gambit to swing the engagement back under his control. Spurred on by adrenaline, bloodlust, and the irresistible compulsion of their leader, a pair of buzzard pilots tried to ram their ships into the nearest Auric squadron, determined to break their formation with a suicide attack. But the Republic pilots didn't panic or break ranks, trying to avoid his reckless charge. Instead, they met the assault head-on, firing their weapons and vaporizing the enemy before any harm could be done. On the other side of the battle, Korpesh's interceptor knifed through the defensive perimeter established around the capital ship and its precious Jedi cargo, too quick and nimble for either the Auric fighters or the turrets to get a lock. Penetrating the Republic lines, Korpesh flew his ship into the heart of the main hangar. The blast doors closed a fraction of a second too late. He opened fire as his ship spun and skidded across the docking bay's floor, wiping out most of the soldiers unfortunate enough to be caught inside. As the ship slowed to a halt, he popped open the hatch and flipped out of his seat. Nimbly landing on his feet, he drew and ignited his lightsaber in one smooth motion. The first sweeping arc of the crimson blade caught the blaster fire of the two troopers who'd survived the initial assault, deflecting it harmlessly away. Another flip closed the 6-meter distance between the Twi'lek and his attackers. Another arc of the blade ended their lives. Korpesh paused to assess the situation. Mangled bodies and shattered machinery were all that remained of the crew and equipment that maintained the Republic fighters. Smiling, he crossed over to the hatch, leading into the interior of the capital ship. He strode quickly and confidently through the halls, guided by the power emanating from the Jedi Master like a toccata drawn by the scent of a squall bug. A security team intercepted him in one of the hallways. The red badges on their sleeves marked them as an elite squad of specially trained soldiers, the best bodyguards the Republic military had to offer. Popesh knew they must have been good. One actually managed to fire her weapon twice before the entire unit fell to his lightsaber. He entered a large chamber with a single door at the back. His prey was beyond that door. But in the center of the room, a pair of Salkath, amphibious beings from the world of Manon, barred his way with lightsabers drawn. These were mere Padawans, however, servants of the Jedi Master. Kopej didn't even bother engaging them in lightsaber combat. It would have been beneath him. Instead, he thrust a meaty fist forward and used the force to hurl them across the room. The first Padawan was stunned by the impact. By the time he struggled uncertainly to his feet, his companion was already dead, the life choked out of her by the power of the dark side. The surviving Padawan retreated as Kopej slowly advanced. The Sith Lord crossed the room with measured strides as he gathered his power. He unleashed it in a storm of electricity, bolts of blue-violet lightning ripping through the flesh of his unfortunate victim. The Salkath's body danced in convulsions of agony until his smoking corpse finally collapsed to the floor. Reaching the door at the rear of the room, Kopej opened it and stepped into the small meditation chamber beyond. An elderly Saurian female, clad in the simple brown robes of a Jedi Master, was seated cross-legged on the floor. Her creased and wrinkled face was bathed in sweat from the strain of using her battle meditation against Khan and the Sith. Exhausted, drained, she was no match for the Sith Lord, who loomed above her. Yet she made no move to flee or even defend herself. With certain death only seconds away, she kept her mind and power focused entirely on the fleet battle. Kopej couldn't help but admire her courage, even as he methodically cut her down. Her calm acceptance robbed his victory of any joy. "Peace is a lie," he muttered to himself as he stalked back through the halls toward the docking bay and his waiting ship, anxious to leave before nightfall or one of the other ships blew the hammerhead to bits. The death of the Jedi Master turned the tide once more. Resistance crumbled. The battle became a Sith rout, and then a slaughter. No longer protected by the power of the light side of the Force, the Republic soldiers were completely demoralized by the terror and despair Khan spawned in their minds. Those who were strong-willed gave up all hope, save that of escaping the battle alive. The weak-willed were left so despondent, they could only hope for a quick and merciful death. The former didn't get what they wanted, but the latter did. Strapped into the hatch of his interceptor, Lord Kopej launched his craft from the hangar mere seconds before the capital ship was destroyed in a glorious and cataclysmic explosion. The Sith losses that day were heavier than expected, but their victory was absolute. Not a single Republic ship, pilot, or soldier escaped the first Battle of Rusan alive. Chapter 10. Bane's power was growing. In only a few months of training, he'd learned much about the Force and the power of the dark side. Physically, he felt stronger than ever before. In morning training runs, he could sprint at nearly full speed for 5 kilometers before he even began breathing heavily. His reflexes were quicker. His mind and senses were sharper than he possibly could have imagined. When necessary, he could channel the Force through his body, giving him bursts of energy that allowed him to do seemingly impossible feats, perform full flips from a standing position, survive falls from incredible heights uninjured. leap vertically 10 meters or more. He was completely aware of his surroundings at all times, sensing the presence of others. Sometimes, he could even get a feel of their intentions, vague impressions of their very thoughts. He was able to levitate larger objects now, and for longer periods. With each lesson, his power grew. It became easier and easier to command the Force and bend it to his will. And with each week, Ben realized he had surpassed another of the apprentices who had once been ahead of him. Less and less of his time was spent in the archive studying the ancient scrolls. His initial fascination with them had faded, swept away by the intensity of academy life. Absorbing the knowledge of masters long dead was a cold and sterile pleasure. Historical records were no competition for the feeling of exhilaration and power he felt when actually using the Force. Bane was part of the Academy and the Brotherhood of the Darkness. He was part of the now, not the ancient past. He began to spend more time mingling with the other students. Already, he could sense that some of them were jealous, though none dared to act against him. Competition among the students was encouraged, and the masters allowed the rivalry to drift into the animosity and hatred that fueled the dark side. But there were harsh penalties for any apprentice caught interfering with or disrupting the training of another student. Of course, all the apprentices understood that the punishment was actually for the crime of being careless enough to get caught. Treachery was tacitly accepted, as long as it was done with enough cunning to avoid the notice of the instructors. Bane's phenomenal progress protected him from the machinations of his fellow students. No one could move against him without drawing the attention of Cordis or the other Sith Lords. Unfortunately, the extra attention made it difficult for Bane himself to use treachery, manipulation, or similar techniques to attain greater status within the Academy. There was, however, one sanctioned way students could bring a rival down. Lightsaber combat. The chosen weapon of both the Jedi and the Sith, the lightsaber was more than just a blade of energy capable of cutting through almost every material in the known galaxy. The lightsaber was an extension of the user and his or her command of the Force. Only those with strict mental discipline and total physical mastery could use the weapon effectively, or so Bane and the others had been taught. Few of the students actually possessed lightsabers yet. They still had to prove themselves worthy in the eyes of Cordis and the others. Yet that didn't keep Lord Cassim, the Twi'lek Blademaster, from instructing them in the styles and techniques they would use once they had finally earned their weapons. Each morning, the apprentices would gather on the wide open roof of the temple to practice their drills and routines under his watchful eye, struggling to learn the exotic maneuvers that would bring them victory on the battlefield. Perspiration was already running down the crown of Bane's head and into his eyes as he put his body through its paces. He blinked away the stinging sweat and redoubled his exertions, carving the air before him again and again and again with his training saber. All around him, other apprentices were doing the same. Each was struggling to conquer his or her own physical limitations and become more than just a warrior with a weapon. The goal was to become an extension of the dark side itself. Bane had begun by learning the basic techniques common to all 7 traditional lightsaber forms. His first weeks had been spent in endless repetitions of defensive postures, overhand strikes, parries, and counter-strikes. By observing the natural tendencies of his students as they learned the basics, Lord Cassim determined which form would best match their style. For Bane, he chose Djemso, Form 5. The fifth form emphasized strength and power, allowing Bane to use his size and muscles to his best advantage. Only after he was able to perform each of the moves of Djemso to the satisfaction of Cassim was he allowed to begin the real training. Now, along with the other students of the academy, he spent the better part of an hour each morning practicing his techniques with his training saber under the Blademaster's watchful eye. Made of durasteel with blunted edges, the training sabers were crafted specifically so that their balance and heft mimicked the energy beams projected by real lightsabers. A solid blow could inflict serious damage, but since a lightsaber did not work that way, Each training blade was also covered with millions of toxin-filled barbs, too small to see, fashioned from the microscopic ridge spines of the deadly Pelco bug, a rare insect found only deep beneath the desert sands of the Valley of the Dark Lords on Korriban itself. With a direct hit, the minuscule barbs could pierce the weave of any fabric. The Pelco venom would cause the flesh immediately to burn and blister. Temporary paralysis set in instantly at the point of infection, leaving any limbs struck all but useless. This provided an excellent way to mimic the effects of losing a hand, arm, or leg to a lightsaber blade. The morning was filled with the grunts of the apprentices and the swish, swish, swish as their blades sliced the air. In some ways, it reminded Bane of his military training, a group of soldiers united in the repetition of drills until the moves became instinctive. But there was no sense of camaraderie at the academy. The apprentices were rivals, plain and simple. In many ways, it wasn't that different from his days on Apatros. Now, however, the isolation was worth it. Here, they were teaching him the secrets of the dark side.
Wrong!
Cassim suddenly barked. He had been walking up and down the ranks of apprentices as they trained, but had now stopped right beside Bane.
Strike with malice and precision.
He reached out and seized Bane's wrist, turning it roughly and changing the angle of the training blade.
You're coming in too high, he snapped. There is no room for error.
He stayed at Bane's side for several seconds, watching to ensure the lesson had been properly learned. After several hard thrusts by Bane with the altered grip, the blade master nodded in approval and continued his rounds. Bane repeated the single move over and over, careful to maintain the height and angle of the blade exactly as Cassim had shown him, teaching his muscles through countless repetitions until they could replicate it flawlessly each and every time. Only then would he move on to incorporating it into more complicated maneuvers. Soon, he was breathing heavily from his exertions. Physically, Cassim's training sessions couldn't measure up to hammering a cortosis vein with a hydraulic jack for hours at a time. But they were far more exhausting in other ways. They demanded intense mental focus and attention to detail that went far beyond what was visible to the naked eye. True mastery of the blade required a combination of both body and mind. When two masters engaged in lightsaber combat, the action happened too quickly for the eye to see or the mind to react. Everything had to be done on instinct. The body had to be trained to move and respond without conscious thought. To accomplish this, Cassim made his students practice sequences, carefully choreographed series of multiple strikes and parries drawn from their chosen style. The sequences were designed by the blade master himself, so that each maneuver flowed smoothly into the next, maximizing attack efficiency while minimizing defensive exposure. Using a sequence in combat allowed the students to free their minds from thought as their bodies automatically continued through the moves. Using sequences was more efficient and much quicker than considering and initiating each strike or block on its own, providing an enormous advantage over an opponent unfamiliar with the technique. However, ingraining a new sequence so it could be properly executed was a long and laborious process. For many, it would take 2 to 3 weeks of training and drills. Longer if the sequence was derived from a style the student was still struggling to master. And even the tiniest mistake in the smallest of moves could render the entire sequence worthless. Cassim had spotted a potentially fatal flaw in Bane's technique. Now Bane was determined to fix it, even if it meant hours of practice on his own time. Bane was relentless in his pursuit of perfection, not just in his combat training, but in all his studies. He was a man on a mission. Enough! Cassim's voice called out. At that single command, all the students stopped what they were doing and turned their attention to the blade master. He was standing at the head of the assemblage facing them.
You may rest for 10 minutes, he told them. Then the challenges will begin.
Bane, along with most of the others, lowered himself into a meditative position, legs crossed and folded beneath him. Laying his training saber on the ground beside him, he closed his eyes and slipped into a light trance, drawing on the dark side to rejuvenate his aching muscles and refresh his tired mind. He let the power flow through him, let his mind drift. As it often did, it drifted back to the first time he'd touched the dark side. Not the fumbling brushes he'd had back on Apatros, or during his days as a soldier, but a true recognition of the Force. It had been his third day here at the Academy. He had been applying the meditation techniques he'd learned the day before, when suddenly, he felt it. It was like the bursting of a dam, a raging river flooding through him, sweeping away all his failings, his weakness, his fear, his self-doubt. In that instant, he'd understood why he was here. At that moment, his transformation from Dez to Bane, from mere mortal to one of the Sith, had truly begun. Through power, I gain victory. Through victory, my chains are broken. Bane knew all about chains. Some were obvious. An abusive, uncaring father, grueling shifts in the mines, debts owed to a faceless, ruthless corporation. Others were more subtle. The Republic, and its idealistic promises of a better life that never materialized. The Jedi, and their vow to rid the galaxy of injustice. Even his friends in the Gloomwalkers had been a kind of chain. He'd cared for them, been responsible for them. Yet in the end, what use had they been when he'd needed them most? He understood now that personal attachments could only hold him back. Friends were a burden. He had to rely on himself. He had to develop his own potential, his own power. In the end, that was what it really came down to, power. And above all else, the dark side promised power. He heard the sounds of movement around him, the soft shuffle of robes as the other apprentices rose from their meditations and made their way toward the challenge ring. He grabbed his training saber with one hand and sprang to his feet to join them. At the end of each session, the class would gather in a wide, irregular circle at the top of the temple. Any student could step into the circle and issue a challenge to another. Cassim would observe the duels closely, and once it was over, he would analyze the action for the class. Those who won would be praised for their performance, and their status in the informal hierarchy of the academy would rise. Those who lost would be chastised for their failings, as well as suffering a blow to their prestige. When Bane had first begun his training, many of the students had eagerly called him out. They knew he was a neophyte in the Force, and they were eager to take down the heavily muscled giant in front of their classmates. At first, he had declined the challenges. He knew they were the quickest way to gain prestige at the academy, but he wasn't foolish enough to be drawn into a battle he was guaranteed to lose. In the past months, however, he'd worked hard to learn his style and refine his technique. He learned new sequences quickly, and when Cassim himself had commented on his progress, Bane had felt confident enough to begin accepting the challenges. He wasn't victorious every time, but he was winning far more duels than he was losing, slowly climbing his way to the top of the ladder. Today, he felt ready to take another step. The apprentices were standing three rows deep, forming a ring of bodies around a clearing in the center roughly 10 meters in diameter. Cassim stepped into the middle. He didn't speak, but merely tilted his head, a sign that it was time for the challenges to begin. Bane stepped into the center before anyone else could make a move.
"A challenge for Harg," he announced in ringing tones.
"I accept,"
came the reply from somewhere in the crowd on the opposite side. The apprentices parted to let the one challenged pass. Cassim gave a slight bow to each combatant and stepped to the clearing's edge to give them room. Foharg was a Mac-Earth. In many ways, he reminded Bane of the Trandoshans he'd fought in his days with the Gloomwalkers. Both species were bipedal saurians, lizard-like humanoids covered in leathery green scales, but the Mac-Earths had four curved horns growing from the top of their heads. Early in Bane's training, he'd fought Foharg, and he'd lost. Badly. The Mac-Earth was nocturnal by nature. Like the miners of the night shift on Apatros, however, he'd grown accustomed to an unnatural schedule in order to train with the rest of the apprentices at the academy. During their first duel, Bane had underestimated Foharg, expecting him to be sluggish and slow during the daylight hours. He wouldn't make that mistake twice. As Cassim and the apprentices watched in silence, the two combatants circled each other in the ring, training sabers held out before them in standard ready stances. The McCurt's breath came in grunts and growls from his flaring nostrils as he tried to intimidate his human opponent. From time to time, he'd give a short bellow and shake his four-horned lizard's head while flashing his savage teeth. The last time he'd faced the green-scaled, snorting demon of an apprentice, Bane had been intimidated by Foharg's act. Now he simply ignored the posturing. Bane lunged out with a simple overhand strike, but Foharg responded with a quick parry to deflect the blow to the side. Instead of the crackle and hum of blades of pure energy crossing, there was a loud clang as the weapons clashed. Immediately the combatants spun away from each other and resumed their ready positions. Bane rushed forward, his blade ascending diagonally from right to left in a long, swift arc. Foharg managed to redirect the impact with his own weapon, but lost his balance and stumbled back. Bane tried to press his advantage, his training saber arcing up from left to right. His opponent spun out of harm's way, backpedaling quickly to create space. Bane broke off the half-completed sequence and settled back into the ready position. Back on Apatros, his latent abilities in the Force had allowed him to anticipate and react to the moves of his foe. Here, however, every opponent enjoyed the same advantage. As a result, victory required a combination of the Force and physical skill. Bane had worked on acquiring that physical skill over the past months. As this ability grew, he was able to devote less and less of his mental energy to the physical actions of thrust, parry, and counter-thrust. This allowed him to keep his mind focused so he could use the Force to anticipate his opponent's moves, while at the same time obscuring and confusing his enemy's own precognitive senses. The last time he and Foharg had fought, Bane had still been a novice. He had only learned a handful of sequences. Now, he knew almost 100, and he was able to transition smoothly from the end of one sequence into the beginning of another, opening up a wider range of attack and defense combinations. And more options made it more difficult for the foe to use the Force to anticipate his actions. Foharg, despite his terrifying appearance, was smaller and lighter than his human opponent. Physically outmatched by the brute force of Bane's Form 5, he was forced to rely on the defensive style of Form 3 to keep his larger opponent's overpowering attacks at bay. Spinning his training saber in a quick flourish, Bane leapt high in the air and came crashing down from above. Foharg parried the attack, but was knocked to the ground. He rolled onto his back and barely managed to get his saber up in time to block Bane's next slashing attack. A chorus of metal on metal rang out as Bane's blows descended like rain. The McCurth kept him from landing a direct hit with a masterful defensive flurry, then swept Bane off his feet with a leg whip, leaving them both supine. They flipped to their feet simultaneously, mirror images, and their sabers met with another resounding crash before they disengaged once again. There were some whispers and mutters from the assembled crowd, but Bane did his best to tune them out. They had thought the battle was over, as had Bane himself. He was disappointed that he hadn't been able to finish off his fallen opponent, but he knew victory was near. Foharg's survival had extracted a heavy toll. He was breathing in ragged gasps now, his shoulders slumping. Bane rushed Foharg again. This time, however, the McCurth didn't back away. He stepped forward with a quick thrust, switching from Form 3 to the more precise and aggressive Form 2. Bane was caught off guard by the unexpected maneuver and was a microsecond slow in recognizing the change. His parry attempt knocked the tip of the blade away from his chest, only to have it slice across his right shoulder. The crowd gasped. Foharg howled in victory, and Bane screamed in pain as the saber slipped to the ground from his suddenly nerveless fingers. Mindlessly, Bane used his other hand to shove his opponent in the chest. Foharg reeled backward, and Bane rolled away to safety. Scrambling to his feet, Bane extended his left hand to the training saber lying on the ground 3 meters away. It sprang up and into his palm, and he once again assumed the ready position, his right arm dangling uselessly at his side. Some Sith learned to fight with either hand, but Bane hadn't yet reached that advanced stage. The weapon felt awkward and clumsy as he held it. Left-handed, he was no match for Foharg. The fight was over. His opponent sensed it as well.
"Defeat is bitter, human,"
he growled in Basic, his voice deep and menacing.
"I have bested you. You have lost."
He wasn't asking Bane to yield. Surrender was never an option. He was simply taunting him, publicly humiliating him in front of the other students.
"You trained for weeks to challenge me,"
Foharg continued, drawing out his mockery.
"You failed. Victory is mine again."
"Then come finish me,"
Bane snapped back. There wasn't much else he could say. Everything his enemy said in his heavily accented Basic was true, and the words cut far deeper than the blunted training saber's edge possibly could.
"This ends when I choose,"
the McCurth replied, refusing to be baited. The eyes of the other apprentices burned into Bane. He could feel them drinking in his suffering as they stared at him. They resented him, resented the extra attention he'd been receiving from the masters. Now, they reveled in his failure.
"You are weak,"
Foharg explained, casually twirling his own saber in a complex and intricate pattern.
"You are predictable."
"Stop it," Bane wanted to scream. "End this. Finish me." But despite the emotion building up inside him, he refused to give his opponent the satisfaction of saying another word. Instead, he let the all but useless saber fall once more to the ground. In the background, he could see the Blade Master watching intently, curious to see how the confrontation would reach its inevitable end.
"The Masters caught at you. They give you extra time and attention. More than the others. More than me."
Bane barely even heard the words anymore. His heart was pounding so loud he could hear the blood coursing through his veins. Literally quaking with impotent rage, he lowered his head and dropped to one knee, exposing his bare neck.
"Despite this, you are still my inferior, Bane of the Sith."
Bane. Something in the way Foharg said it caused Bane to glance up. It was the same way his father used to say the word. "That name is mine," Bane whispered, his voice low and threatening. "Nobody uses it against me." Foharg either didn't hear him or didn't care. He took a leisurely step forward.
"Bane, worthless, an insignificant nothing. The Masters wasted their time on you. Time better spent on other students. You are well named, for you truly are this academy's Bane."
"No!"
Bane screamed, thrusting his good hand out, palm forward, even as Foharg leapt in to finish him off. Dark side energy erupted from his open palm to catch his opponent in midair, hurling him back to the edge of the crowd where he landed at Cassim's feet. The master watched with an intrigued but wary expression. Bane slowly clenched his fist and rose to his feet. On the ground before him, Foharg was writhing in agony, clutching at his throat and gasping for breath. Unlike the McCurth, Bane had nothing to say to his helpless opponent. He squeezed his fist harder, feeling the force rushing through him like a divine wind as he crushed the life out of his foe. Foharg's heels pounded out a staccato rhythm on the temple stone roof as his body convulsed. He began to gurgle and pink froth welled up from between his lips.
"Enough, Bane,"
Cassim said in a cold, even voice. Though he stood only centimeters away from the death throes of his student, his eyes were fixed on the one still standing. A final surge of power roared up in the core of Bane's being and exploded out into the world. In response, Foharg's body went stiff and his eyes rolled back in his head. Bane released his hold on the Force and his fallen enemy, and the McCurth's body went limp as the last vestiges of life ebbed away. Now it's enough, Bane said, turning his back on the corpse and walking toward the stairs that led back inside the temple. The circle of students quickly opened a path for him to pass. He didn't need to look back to know that Cassim was watching him with great interest. Bane felt the presence of someone following him down the stairs from the temple roof long before he heard the footsteps. He didn't change his pace, but he did stop at the first landing and turn to face whoever it was. He half expected to see Lord Cassim, but instead of the Blade Master, he found himself staring into the orange eyes of Sirak, another apprentice at the academy. Or rather, the top apprentice at the academy. Sirak was a Zabrak, one of three apprenticing here on Korriban. Zabrak tended to be ambitious, driven, and arrogant. Perhaps it was these traits that made the Force Sensitives of the race so strong in the ways of the dark side. And Sirak was the perfect embodiment of those characteristics. He was far and away the strongest of the three. Wherever Sirak went, the other two usually followed, trailing at his heel like obedient servants. They made a colorful trio. Red-skinned Loke and Yivra, and pale-yellow Sirak. But right now, the other two were conspicuously absent. There were rumors that Sirak had begun studying the ways of the dark side under Lord Cordis nearly 20 years ago, long before the academy at Korriban had been resurrected. Bane didn't know if the rumors were true, and he hadn't thought it wise to ask about it. The Iridonian Zabrak was both powerful and dangerous. So far, Bane had done his best to avoid drawing the attention of the academy's most advanced student. Apparently, that strategy was no longer an option. The rush of adrenaline he'd felt as he'd ended Fulharg's life was fading, along with the confidence and sense of invincibility that had led to his dramatic exit. Bane wasn't exactly afraid as the Zabrak approached him, but he was wary. In the dim torchlight of the temple, Sirak's pale yellow skin had taken on a sickly waxen hue. Unbidden, it brought back memories of Bane's first year working the mines in Apatros. A crew of 5, 3 men and 2 women, had been trapped in a cave-in. They had survived the collapsing tunnel by escaping into a reinforced safety chamber dug out of the rock. But noxious fumes released in the collapse had seeped into their haven and killed them all before rescue teams could dig them out. The complexion of their bloated corpses was the exact same color as Sirak's. The color of a slow, agonizing death. Bane shook his head, pushing the memory away. That life belonged to Dez, and Dez was gone.
What do you want?
He asked, trying to keep his voice calm.
You know why I am here, was the icy response. Fulharg.
Was he a friend of yours?
Bane was genuinely confused. With the exception of his fellow Zabrak, Sirak rarely mingled with the other students. In fact, many of the accusations Fulharg had leveled at Bane, such as preferential treatment from the Masters, could easily be applied to Sirak as well.
The McCurth was neither friend nor enemy, was the haughty reply. He was beneath my notice, as were you, until now.
Bane's only reply was a steady, unblinking stare. The flickering torchlight reflecting off the Zabrak's pupils made it seem as if hungry flames licked away at the inside of his skull.
You are an intriguing opponent,
Sirak whispered, taking a step closer.
Formidable, at least compared with the other so-called apprentices here. I am watching you now. I'm waiting.
He reached out slowly and pressed his finger into Bane's chest. Bane had to fight the urge to take a step back.
I do not issue challenges, the Zabrak continued. I have no need to test myself against a lesser opponent.
Flashing a cruel smile, he lowered his finger and took a step back.
However, when you fool yourself into believing you are ready, you will inevitably challenge me. I shall be looking forward to it.
With that, he brushed past Bane on the narrow landing, bumping him slightly with the shoulder, as if unaware of him, then continuing on down the stairs to the level below. The message of that slight bump was not lost on Bane. He knew Sirach was trying to intimidate him and to goad him into a confrontation Bane wasn't ready for. He wasn't about to fall for the trap. Instead, he stood motionless at the top of the landing, refusing to turn and watch Sirach depart. Only when he heard the sounds of the rest of the class descending from the roof did he move again, spinning on his heel and continuing down the stairs to the lower levels and the privacy of his own room. Chapter 11. The next morning, Bane was not with the other students on the temple roof as they sparred. Lord Cordis wanted to speak with him privately. He strode through the virtually empty halls of the academy toward the meeting, his outward appearance calm and confident. Inside, he was anything but. All night, as he lay surrounded by the silence and darkness of his room, the duel had played itself over and over in his head. Free from the emotion of the battle, he knew he'd gone too far. He'd proven his dominance over Fulhard by pinning him with the Force. He'd achieved Dune Mok. The McCurth would never dare to challenge him again. Yet, for some reason, Bane hadn't been able to stop there. He hadn't wanted to stop. At the time, he had felt no guilt over his actions, no remorse. Yet once his blood cooled, part of him couldn't help but feel he had done something wrong. Had Fulhard really deserved to die? But another part of him refused to accept the guilt. He had no love for the McCurth, no feelings at all. Fulhard had been nothing but an obstacle to Bane's progress, an obstacle that had been removed. He had given himself over to the dark side completely in that moment. It had been more than simple rage or bloodlust. It went deeper, to the very core of his being. He'd lost all reason and control, but it had felt right. Bane had spent a long and sleepless night trying to reconcile the two emotions, triumph and remorse. But when the summons came that morning, his inner conflict had been swept away by more immediate concerns. Fulhard's death would have repercussions. Combat was supposed to test the apprentices, harden their mettle through struggle and pain. It wasn't meant to kill. Each and every disciple at the academy, from Sirach down to the least and lowest of the students, had the ability to become a master. Each possessed an extremely rare gift in the dark side, a gift that was meant to be used against the Jedi, not against one another. In killing Fulhard, Bane had thinned the ranks of potential Sith Masters. He had dealt a serious blow to the war effort. Each apprentice at the academy was valued more highly than an entire division of Sith troopers. He had destroyed an invaluable tool. For that, Bane suspected, he would be punished severely. As he marched toward the meeting that could decide his fate, he tried to push both fear and guilt from his mind. Nothing he did now could bring Fulhard back. The McCurth was gone, but Bane was still here. And he was a survivor. He had to be strong. He had to find some way to justify his actions to Lord Cordis. He was already putting together his arguments. Fulhard had been weak. Bane hadn't just killed him, he'd exposed him. Cordis and the other masters encouraged rivalry and dissension among their charges. They understood the value of challenge and competition. Those who showed promise, the individuals who elevated themselves above the others, were rewarded. They received one-on-one instruction with the masters to reach their full potential. Those who could not keep up were left behind. That was the way of the dark side. Fulhard's death was no more than a natural extension of the dark side philosophy. His death was the ultimate failure, his own failure. Why should Bane be blamed for another's weakness? His pace quickened and he clenched his teeth in angry frustration. No wonder his emotions were so conflicted. The teachings of the academy were self-contradictory. The dark side allowed for no mercy, no forgiveness. Yet, the apprentices were expected to pull back once they had bested their opponents in the dueling ring. It was unnatural. He had reached the threshold of Cordis' door. He hesitated, briefly wavering between fear of what his punishment would be and anger at the impossible situation he and all the other apprentices were put in every day. Anger, he finally decided, would serve him best. He knocked sharply at the door, then opened it when the commander enter came from within. Cordis was near.